software for the mind. The Recorded Book Corporation is proud to present Stuart Wilde's important and omniscient collection, The Mastery of Life series.
This is Stuart Wilde. Welcome to our two-tape series on dreams and dream power. Before we start talking about dreams and the nature of dreams and how you can use them to sort of learn about yourself or to learn about aspects of your inner self or your unconscious, let me first talk to you a little bit about how I see our daytime waking life, how I see our evolution through the physical plane. If you're familiar with my books and tapes or you've listened to some of my philosophies in my seminars and so on, just bear with me for a moment as I recapitulate some of the main points that I have to offer. What I believe is that in the physical plane, we are basically here to understand the physical experience, that you're not your body or your mind or your soul or your emotions or the color of your skin or the religion that you signed up for. You're basically an infinite energy inside a body that's come down to the earth plane to basically understand itself. I call that infinite energy the higher self. And I believe the higher self is this vast, powerful body of energy that is part of the eternal light, and that it comes into the physical plane in order basically to experience a concentration of itself. You know, when you're in a physical body, you have to really concentrate on living. If you make the slightest mistake, you can be sort of blipped out, or you can depart the physical plane. And so as we go through life, the lessons we learn are basically very, very real lessons. It's literally, we sort of bang our knuckles up against the hardness of life, and we understand bit by bit how it works, and we understand bit by bit the various aspects of our inner self. We come to a kind of transcendent understanding of who we are and what we're doing. As a higher self comes into the physical plane, I believe that it has an ability to see what it's going to be getting into. I don't think that we come to the physical plane as a kind of sort of cosmic Russian roulette or through happenstance. I think that the higher self has a vision of like where it's going to be born, who the family is, the nature of the family, the religion, the color of the skin, the country, the conditions. And very much more than that, it has also a perception, I believe, of the mindset of the people. Because when you're born, you very much take on, you know, just the belief patterns that your mum and dad hold, whatever they might be. And you're so influenced by society and by everything that is sort of around you within the educational system. And your mind begins to record all of this stuff from birth. And in the end, it makes up your personality. It makes up who you are. And you are only really the product of all of those things that you've been told. And so I believe the higher self sees this and can see the quality or the lack of quality or the strength or the weakness of the mindset. And I believe it accepts that. It accepts the whole evolution inside the earth plane as a way of learning about itself and as a way of like transcending to like a higher or more powerful spiritual energy. So when you look at your body isn't you. When you look at your mind, it isn't you either. It is the contents that have been like infused into the mind over all the years that you've been on the physical plane. But it isn't actually you. What you are is like an infinite energy beyond the mind, beyond the body. And perhaps you've had that feeling sometimes when you've, let's say, looked at yourself in the bathroom mirror and you've had this kind of eerie sensation of thinking, well, who is it that's looking at who? You know, like, am I looking at me or who's that face? Who is this person? And you get this kind of eerie sensation that you realize that your body, although it is you in the one sense, in the physical sense, it's not you in the sort of deeper meaning of life. As we look at trying to understand dreams, the whole function of understanding one's dreams is that it is an aspect of humanhood. It's one of the things that, you know, we can study or we can research or we can learn about in the same way as geography and travel or mathematics and science or motherhood or whatever it is, are just areas that we can get ourselves interested in to help us understand the physical plane. I believe that you're here in the physical plane basically to collect experiences. And the more experiences you collect, the more rounded, the more full a human being you become. And also, the more confident you become and the more sort of positive you become. Because once you've had an experience or once you've collected one particular experience in the physical plane, then you have a knowledge of it. And then next time you're faced with a similar experience, you come out of the confidence of thinking, oh gosh, I've already done that once. I know how to do that. And so the whole function of looking at your dreams is basically to learn more about yourself. It's just one more area of experiencing life or studying life. Let's look at the components that make up, let's say, the total you. You have your physical body. You have your conscious mind, the awake part of you, during the regular day. You have your unconscious mind, which is all of the other memories and thoughts and feelings that are contained in your mind. And it's important here for me to mention that, like, nothing is ever really lost from your mind. All the experiences of your life are still contained in there. And then beyond that, or below the unconscious or subconscious mind, is what Jung called the collective unconscious. And the collective unconscious is basically the sum total of all the thoughts that have ever been. It is sometimes called the universal mind. And he postulated that it was a body of energy that, like, existed that we could pull information from. Then beyond that is this divine energy inside of you, the higher self, or this spark of the God force, I believe it to be, whereby that is where your real identity lies. If you look at a person, they will have their outside personality, or as Jung called it, persona. And that will be like the official sort of front that they will give to society. It's what I call the official printout. And then below the official printout, in the unconscious or in that real you within you, are all of those qualities that actually make up what you are. In a person that has done a lot of work upon themselves, a person that has really, really set upon a quest to transcend, to understand themselves, the difference between the inner person, the real person, and the more sort of fake personality is not usually very, very great. However, if you haven't done a lot of work upon yourself and you haven't spent much time of your life looking at your inner motivations, your feelings, your emotions, who you are, what do you believe, where you're going, that sort of thing, then dreams are incredibly useful because they allow you to look at what is coming forward from the unconscious, from the inner mind, and you can see what it is you really believe. I think the whole point in the physical plane is for us to reach a kind of relaxed state where we can be what it is that we are. You know what it's like when you meet a person that's like terribly phony. They're kind of a drag to hang out with them because when they're talking to you, you constantly are aware of the fact that they're sort of not lying, but they're presenting to you this whole sort of theatrical story that's nothing to do with what is truth, what is real, what is meaningful. And so after a while, you can't be bothered with them. And those kind of people are like extremely irritating to deal with for any length of time because you're constantly listening to their ego, to their stuff, to all their little attitudes and all their sort of foibles. And they're not coming out of being natural and not coming out of being real. When you get comfortable with yourself, you'll begin to take an attitude that, like, I am what I am. I don't have to apologize. I don't have to defend myself. I don't have to explain it to anybody if I don't want to. I'm a child of the universe. And although I'm not necessarily perfect, I am the sum total of all of my experiences, and you'll have to accept me as I am. And then what happens is you can begin to come out of an energy of truth, and you can begin to say to people or communicate to people what it is you need. You can tell them what it is you're actually thinking. You don't have to come up with, like, white lies or fake attitudes or all sorts of sort of social stuff that people require of you. And you settle in this natural process of, like, continuing to understand yourself, continuing to strengthen yourself, continuing to create this transcendent personality. And transcendence really means going from the ego printout, the official story that the persona creates for itself, into a person that is very, very settled into their inner self, into what they actually are. And so that's the whole function of looking at dreams, and that's the whole function of even looking at yourself, whether you do it during your dream time, or whether you do it in meditation, or quiet periods, or sanctuary, or whether you go consult with a friend, or a psychologist, or a psychoanalyst, or whatever. But it's basically this sort of search for, who am I? You know, what do I actually believe? What is truth to me? What makes me feel powerful and strong and confident and happy? And what makes me feel weak and lousy and negative and uptight? And as you begin to identify that, you begin to develop a more powerful lifestyle, a lifestyle that is more, let's say, imbued with like a natural sense of gaiety and freedom, and a lifestyle that is like more creative. Because the more you go beyond the stuff of the ego and the personality, the more you do touch into this universal life force, the universal mind, and your thoughts become more spontaneous and they become more sort of lucid, and you can create and think and imagine and fantasize and bring things to life more readily than if you're just thinking them through logically. Everybody has dreams. Even if you don't necessarily remember your dreams, that doesn't mean that you're not dreaming at night. In fact, during an average night's sleep, you will have a number of sustained dream periods. And then also you will have other periods where you go into a hypnagogic state, which is basically that state where you're looking at little images. They're often called dreamlets. And so by being able to like understand dreams through the research that's been done in various dream laboratories around the world, the scientists began to find out exactly when a person was dreaming and when they weren't dreaming. One of the major breakthroughs was when they realized that during dream periods, you have eye movement. And that eye movement is known as REM, R-E-M, which stands for rapid eye movement. Once they discovered that dreaming takes place when rapid eye movement takes place, they were able to identify dream periods, and they could wake up the experimenters and say, were you dreaming? And each and every time that the dreamer was going through rapid eye movement, they always reported being in some kind of dream state. The whole point of it was that they began to be able to like trace exactly how many dream periods happened during the night. The other thing that they began using was an EEG machine, which is basically a machine that measures brainwave activity. And so they could begin to discern various levels of sleep. We don't just conk out at night and go to sleep and wake up in the morning. Our brain is consistently active, as are all of our senses, and we move through various brain speeds. The speed of the brain is basically the oscillation of the neurons in the brain. And we move through four distinct stages of sleep at night. We drop down from the waking stage through the first, second, and third, and fourth stage, and then we come back up again through the first stage, and then down again, and so on. And so it's this sort of up and down, almost roller coaster movement during the night. Each one of the stages of sleep I'll talk about in a short while, but it's basically, they can be identified as having various functions. The stage one is predominantly a REM period when you're dreaming. The stage two and three are healing stages, or times when there is synthesis of protein or hormones are being like fired into the body. And the stage four sleep is like deep, deep unconscious, which not that very much is known about it, because when people awake from, let's say, a stage four sleep, they have very little recall of what is actually going on. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of the various dream states, let's just look at what is a dream. You know, what do we mean when we say a dream? In fact, it's really very, very hard to define, because it is only really a conscious function or a function of the mind. And so you can't really put your hand on what is a dream, although we know what it is because we've all had dreams and we understand the subjective or inner experience of what a dream is. But it is basically an altered state of consciousness, the same way as the waking state is one state of consciousness and the dream state is another state, and let's say deep meditation or trance is a third state. As we look at dreams, there are many types of dreams, there are many variations in dreams. You know, there are lucid dreams where you're awake and you know that you're dreaming. There are warning dreams and prophetic dreams, and there are dreams that are just these, what I mentioned before, the hypnagogic dreams, where they're just little symbols or dreamlets that come into the mind's eye while you're falling asleep, usually in stage one. There are nightmares, and then beyond that, there's all of sort of the mystical experiences that may be described as dreams or may be described in other terms. For example, the out-of-body experience, astral travel, trance states. And those are some of the things that we'll be talking about in these tapes later on. The whole study of dream interpretation is basically as old as time. You know, the Red Indians have been involved in it for like thousands and thousands of years, and of course also the Aboriginals here in Australia. And since ancient times, people have believed that, like, within dreams, we received messages from the gods. I'd like to read you one page of a little article that I did on dreams and the ancient wisdoms to give you an understanding of how those people in those types of civilizations regarded dreams and how they felt that they could, like, incubate dreams to sort of solicit a message from the gods. In the ancient world, philosophers and mystics paid careful attention to dreams. They made the same distinction about dreams that psychoanalysts do today, that there are different types of dreams, little or what we might call personal dreams, as opposed to big or collective dreams, which was sometimes taken as the revelation of God to the dreamer. Nowadays, psychologists observe that these big dreams, which are remarkable for the unusual beauty or bizarreness of their imagery, often recapitulate ancient religions and mythological works and occur at critical stages of life, at crisis points where the ego needs to become adapted to new circumstances, new stages of life, or where the ego could otherwise benefit from the greater knowledge and wisdom which the conscious process of the inner world provides. Sometimes the dreamer can understand what the dream is trying to communicate to him, but sometimes help is required. In the ancient world, professional dream interpreters existed to assist people in this way. Their rules for dream interpretation were recorded in such books as Artemidorus's Art of Judging Dreams, which has survived to the present day. Artemidorus traveled from city to city, speaking with dream interpreters, who often had booths at local festivals, in much the same way as the great alchemist Paracelsus, who said he derived his philosophy from the mouths of midwives and miners. These ancient dream books, while they were very interesting for their symbolic reasoning and the light they cast on ancient customs, have little to offer the modern dreamer. Our evolution today is so accelerated and individuality so highly developed that preformed interpretations of any kind are seldom very accurate. And yet modern dream books exist which are not so very far different from the ancient ones. Since the ancients believed that dreams were revelations from the gods, it was only natural for them to attempt to induce this sort of meaningful dream. This attempt for them was a natural part of their religious practices. The method was called incubation, just as we may think of incubating a seed or an infant. They hoped to plant the seed of a meaningful dream by prayer, fasting, baptism, and other ritual observances. One particularly famous instance of this method of incubation took place at the temple of Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine and healing, where after observing these preliminary procedures, the supplicant would spend the night in the courtyard of the temple, where he would be visited by the gods in a dream and receive advice about his problem, usually a grave illness. Many of these were cases that conventional physicians at that time were unable to help, and great many cures were effected in this way. If you think about it, this is perhaps not so difficult to believe, for within us is a source of knowledge, the higher self, about the causes and cures of our sickness or states of mind. As for the gods, this may be thought of as the symbol through which the unconscious wisdom could express itself. That these supplicants should have dreamt of the gods is not really unusual. Think of a time when you have concentrated for a good part of the day on something, not a part of your usual routine. You will almost certainly dream of it later that night. These methods of inducing meaningful dreams were carried on for centuries. For example, the medieval magicians and alchemists were quite sophisticated in their use of perfumes and incense for this purpose. The symbolism of the planets was the basis of their system, and an elaborate doctrine of correspondences between natural things and the inner worlds was developed. According to this doctrine, minerals, metals, plants, animals, and just about everything was linked to the symbolic idea of one of the planets. So if you wanted to induce a dream of, say, knowledge and wisdom, which would be an affair of the planet Saturn, one would choose an incense or perfume that belonged to Saturn, such as pine or dittany, and as one fell asleep, burn it upon a plate of lead, being the metal of Saturn. If one wanted to dream of love or art, one would use the Venus plant, or the rose, and placed it upon a plate of copper, which was the metal of Venus. In our own century, the magical poet William Buster Yeats, who was deeply involved in a school of hermetic magic for most of his adult life, used this very same method. In his diaries, he described how he used to place blossoms on his pillow for this purpose, often the hawthorn blossom, traditionally associated with those etheric beings which survive in our nursery stories or fairy stories, or the apple blossom, which Yeats associated with the Celtic gods of art and visionary wisdom. All of the ancient traditions include this idea of incubating the great dream, and most of the ancient traditions believed in the idea of some kind of revelation from God being included in the dreams. Muhammad believed that dreams were conversations between man and God, but eventually the structure around his church sort of took control of that, and so eventually the teaching became that the only way that you could have a dream interpreted was to have one of the mullahs of the Muslim faith interpret it for you. The Greeks believed in dreams being the messages of the gods, and of course the Delphic Oracle was there to basically explain to the populace what these dreams meant. In the Christian church, originally they believed in the same idea of dreams coming from God, but then after the writings of Saint Jerome, things changed, because Saint Jerome must have had an awful lot of, like, extremely horny dreams, because he was constantly plagued by these sort of dreams with, like, massive sexual contents or dreams that he felt were contrary to the Christian teaching. And so he wrote a great work on dreams and said that basically that dreams were like part of the temptation of the devil. And after Saint Jerome had come and gone, the Christians were not allowed to consider their dreams as revelations from the gods anymore. And so somehow the teaching there changed. But basically speaking, throughout the whole history of time, we've had this relationship between us and the inner mind, or the universal mind. After the appearance of Freud in Vienna in the late 1800s, the way that man understood the inner workings of the mind, or the psyche, changed very, very dramatically. He gave a lot of experiences that we sort of knew to be there actual real terms, and he began to explain to people the various functions of mind. In fact, Freud was the father of psychoanalysis. Basically speaking, his view was that dreams were not just the haphazard firing of the brain, but that they had a meaning. The sort of the mumbo-jumbo part of dreaming he called the manifest content, and the meaningful dreams or the dreams that were appertaining to one's personal life he called the latent content. And what he decided, or what he came up with, was that there was a logical interpretation through psychoanalysis to discover what those dreams actually meant. And in fact, that seems to me logical, because if a dream comes from your mind, there must be some explanation as to why it's there. He said that there were like two functions of dreams, that first and foremost, dreams were like our way of expressing like forbidden wishes. You have to remember that Freud lived at a time of extreme sexual repression. And of course, in the Victorian times, people were very, very puritanical and very uptight, and there was a million laws about what you could do and what you couldn't do. And so it was probably natural that most of his clients or his customers were like young women or young men who had extreme, let's say, sexual libidos, but were not in any position to express that sexuality. And so he came to the conclusion that, like, most of the dreams that these people had were of this sort of forbidden wish category, where they were expressing some kind of innate sexuality or innate anger or some, let's say, forbidden desire, for example, homosexuality or whatever it may be. The other thing that Freud said was that in our dream times, the inner self conceals from the personality the true meaning of dreams, that quite often dream symbols are reversed because the personality cannot actually face the truth. So if, say, for example, a young man was, let's say, latently homosexual, his inner dreams would not be able to express that to him and would hide that fact from him. Freud claimed that we all have inside of us a function or an entity or an idea called the sensor, and that sensor rules our innermost parts of our mind and hides us from our deepest, let's say, most sort of base inclinations. And that's why many of the dreams, Freud said, were, let's say, reversed, because it was really like you couldn't talk to the outside personality from the inner mind without passing through the office of the censor, who would change it all around so that you felt comfortable with yourself. The other thing that Freud said, which was later sort of generally disagreed with, was that he came up with some very rigid ideas of what dream symbology means. Nowadays, most dream experts and most people that experiment or are scientifically involved in the study of dreams, they believe that dream symbols are personal to the dreamer. In other words, if I dream of a black cat and you dream of a black cat, that does not necessarily mean the same thing to both of us. To me, the black cat may mean occult and witchcraft, and to you, the black cat may mean a symbol of softness or femininity. However, Freud's interpretation was more rigid, and so he had, like, sort of precise symbols that he said always meant the same thing. Because the whole crux of his teaching was around repressed sexuality, he found sort of in dream symbology all sorts of sexual symbols. So anything sort of long-shaped or pointed or a stick or a pencil was always, let's say, a penis or a penis substitute. And anything that was like a cave or an oyster shell or round was obviously vaginal. And so he took all of these dream symbols to express this repressed sexuality. Nowadays, in the modern era, we don't come out of that same kind of sexual repression. And so a lot of that very sort of rigid interpretation that Freud gave is no longer appropriate today. Whereas some of those symbols may be sexual symbols in your dreams, often they may not be. And so a sword may be a phallic symbol. On the other hand, it may be a sword. And so things have changed since Freud's time. But what was neat about Freud was that he laid the groundwork, and much of his work is still very influential today. And of course, he was the pioneer and the founder of this whole science. And so he had to go in cold and kind of make it up as he went along and stick his neck out, basically. And since then, other people have come along and modified it and made it more sort of apropos to the way we live our lives today. After Freud, the most significant person at that time was Carl Jung, who was a close associate of Freud. He didn't actually agree totally with all of Freud's teachings, and he took a much more mystical approach to dreams. He believed basically that dreams were a facade, and that in fact that dreams were a part of nature. In many ways, I agree with Carl Jung, because you can see, for example, if you watch, let's say, the family dog or cat asleep, you can tell that it is dreaming. You know, it moves its little legs, or it barks, or it wags its tail, and you can watch the eyes moving inside your animal, and you can see that, like, dreaming is a natural part of consciousness upon the earth plane. Carl Jung said that there were three levels of consciousness: the waking state, or conscious living, the subconscious, which is, let's say, what I call the inner mind, and then below the inner mind, he said there was the collective unconscious, which I call the universal mind. And what he said the collective unconscious was all the thoughts that we've ever had, those sort of symbols that come through from all time, which come through as part of, like, primitive man. If you believe in reincarnation, you might think that the collective unconscious is, let's say, all the thoughts that you've had in your past lives, and all the thoughts or all the things that you learned in those lives. But anyway, Jung believed that we dream in those particular levels, and that when we get into the collective unconscious, then we can have the great dream that absolutely changes our life.
This is the end of the side. Please fast forward.